It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Man, we have a great panel for you. Lori Gill from iMore stopping by. Andy Anacco from the Celestial Waste of Bandwidth. And from The Loop, Jim Dalrymple. We're going to talk about Apple's reveal, what to expect to the Mac Pro in 2019, and whether those new chips Apple's reportedly designing will be in it. You stay tuned. Mac Break Weekly is next. The Red iPhone.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 605, recorded Tuesday, April 10th, 2018. Super sexy swinging sounds. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/MacBreak. And by 23andMe, a personal genetic service helping people understand their DNA. Buy your 23andMe kit today at 23andme.com/twit. And by TurboTax Live, new from TurboTax. Now you can get a personal review of your tax return with a CPA or EA right on your screen. Talk live with a tax expert as often as you need for tax advice to help you file with confidence. Go to TurboTaxLive.com/MacBreak. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we get together with the best Mac journalists in the world to talk about the latest news from Apple. And I want to welcome the beard. He's here, ladies and gentlemen, Jim Dalrymple from loopinsight.com. Hi, Jim.
How you doing, Leo?
I am wonderful. Summer treating you well. Is it summer yet?
It is summer. I'm in California, too.
Yeah, so it's beautiful. The weather is going to be 75 today. The leaf blowers are out.
Construction workers.
What are those headphones you're wearing? I have to ask Jim, because he's a real audiophile. Those look pretty heavy duty there.
Yeah, they're AKG.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I really like AKG stuff. So
I wear K240s in the studio, as many professionals do.
Yes.
Because they're comfy. And look, there's a small four-legged creature wandering behind you. I don't know if it's yours, but just so you're aware, Andy Anacco is also here. Anacco.com. Great to see you, Andy. Boy, you look good. You look, the lighting is really flattering.
Yeah, it's getting there. The blackout curtains went up like last week and have been adjusted properly. It's like, yeah, if I were better at what I do, then this would all have been done within 1 week. But now it's like, no, we got 45 minutes before the next show. Let's spend a frantic half hour adjusting things to where they should be permanently.
Nice. Oh, and I recognize that laugh. It's Lori Gill, deputy managing editor of iMore. She's the app-aholic.
I like the apps. What can I say?
If you've got any Animal Crossing tips you want to pass along, Lori, please.
I do. I have many. If you're an Animal Crossing player, come my way, because I have lots of things to say.
Ooh, I can't wait. I can't wait. I like this one. Here's a recent article. How to prepare your HomePod for sale.
Hey, you know, people, they buy it, they change their mind, it was given to them as a gift.
Yeah.
They need to know.
Yeah.
They need to know.
How to prepare it to get rid of it. So, the big story of the week this week comes from Matthew Panzerino in TechCrunch. I don't know, he didn't mention anybody else being there. He was one of the five journalists invited to Apple last year during the famous apology tour, where Apple said, oops, we blew it. The Mac Pro is a dead end. We have painted ourselves into a corner, and we won't have one for you this year, but we are working on a new one. Matthew went back almost exactly a year later to Apple and got a little peek under the kimono, and there is a Mac Pro, but it won't be ready this year.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be great if they at least showed off something? I think one of the nicest things one of the most valuable things that came out of that piece was Apple's acknowledgement that their normal position of utter secrecy and denial until they actually unveil the thing was not working out for people who, you know, have to make plans for buying new hardware at a certain set rate of time. So they made the point of one of the reasons why they're conducting these interviews and making these semi announcements was to reassure people that here's what we can show you to reassure you that if you are going to be in a position, we're going to need new hardware in 2019, we might have something for you. But if you need something this year, you best make other plans, because that really kneecaps a lot of people.
I think that's so true. I think I know a lot of people who, you know, they're always asking me about whether or not they should upgrade their Mac. And when it comes to professional Macs, this is definitely something they need to know. Should I invest now? Should I put this on this fiscal year? Should I wait? Is there going to be something in September if I buy now? Did I just waste my money? And I think it was really smart on Apple's part to be transparent about the fact that it's not coming this year and it'll be here next year, but they didn't even give us a specific timeline. Next year could be in the first quarter. It could be at the end of the year. But I think it was really smart to kind of let us know, let the professionals know that if they're thinking of buying, that they're not going to get a new Mac Pro until 2019. And if this has to do with, you know, kind of keeping your financial records together, you might go ahead and purchase at least some of those professional grade Macs before the end of the quarter, because you're not going to get anything new until 2019.
All right, I'm going to give you the negative spin.
That's not a surprise.
Apple's saying, please buy an iMac Pro. They're saying, I mean, you're right. It's that message, but it feels like you're saying, oh, isn't this wonderful? But really, what it's Apple saying is, look, just buy the iMac Pro. Please don't wait for a Mac Pro. I understand that's a benefit to some people, and I even said they should tell people if they're going to make something this year or not. But it could also really be that they're saying, you know, buy the iMac Pro, please buy the iMac Pro.
I don't know that what they're saying, though. I mean, do we want the choice here seems pretty clear. Apple can try and release something because people expect it, or they can wait, make sure it's ready, and, you know, a whole new modular design, whatever that turns out to be and whatever the form factor turns out to be, will be released when it's actually ready to go. Imagine if they release something that really wasn't up to what they wanted. People would be all over it. We'd be slamming them, saying, why didn't they wait? So instead of doing that, they come out and say, we're not going to have it this year. You know, make your plans. If you want to buy an iMac Pro, that's, you know, people can do that. It is a powerful machine. But if you want to wait for this new modular design, then here's our sort of timeline.
Yeah.
Next year.
We did see that with the previous Mac Pro, to be fair. Here is something that you have not been asking us for that does not meet your needs as you choose to define them. Good luck.
Ah, but innovate my ass. Tom Boger, Senior Director of Mac Hardware Product Marketing, Panzerino quotes him as saying, we know there are a lot of customers today that are making purchase decisions on the iMac Pro and whether or not they should wait for the Mac Pro. He doesn't finish that sentence. But I think I can finish it. Don't wait. Right?
Well, that's correct to a certain extent. Again, it's valuable to let people know that if you were holding off for, let's say, WWDC particularly, to say that I bet that they're going to announce something then.
Yeah.
To have at least a year in advance, knowing that no, nothing is coming in 2018. You don't need to. If this isn't waiting for Godot, you may as well leave the barren spot with a tree, go back to your motorhome with a microwave oven and the TV, because you're gonna have to dig in. I think Apple is also savvy enough to know that a lot of people. This frees up them to not simply say, well, I'm just going to have to buy an iMac. It does free up a lot of people to think, okay, this is where I switch to Windows because I can't wait another year and a half.
That's not what Boger meant. That is not the rest of Boger's sentence.
No, I know that's not what he meant, but that is part of the effect.
There are a lot of pros that will wait.
Yeah.
And some of those industries, including music, are already a bit further behind than, you know, what they already have. Because in music, I don't know about video or photography, but in music, once you get your system set up, you leave it alone.
Right.
I mean, sometimes there's no updates, there's no nothing, because it's working, it's recording, and any downtime is money. And if they do get a new machine, a lot of times they'll run that in parallel to the old machine that they know works. So you know that a new machine is going to come with the newest operating system. And a lot of times that won't work with some music software until it's updated.
That's a good point.
So
yeah.
Even my music machine, the one that I record all my things on in Logic and Pro Tools, is always an operating system behind. So I'm not running High Sierra on that machine intentionally.
Yeah.
Because it works right now. And I know when I go in and I plug in my guitar and I set up the mics, I get everything rolling, everything is going to work. If I update something, it could break. So my point is, for those industries, it's not necessarily a bad thing that they're waiting a year. You know, they're not going to care that much. Next year, studios may bring one in.
But see, you're not. I'm going to bet, Jim, you're not using the trash can Mac Pro either.
I am not. I'm using an iMac.
Yeah. So you, because that's the real problem. People who bought, as I did, a Mac Pro in 2013 are now sitting in year five saying, oh, another year? Right?
But I don't think that
they're
going to
buy an iMac Pro. They're going to. Well,
they may. Yeah. They may.
I mean,
that's a definite option with the iMac Pro being as good quality as it is. I think that was one of the reasons why Apple kind of went for that, is that they're not, the Mac Pro is just not going to be ready in time. So here's the supplement. If you really feel like you have to upgrade, if you can't wait, here's the iMac Pro, and it works great, and it's going to satisfy a lot of people's needs. But at the same time, just like Jim is saying, it's true. The people I know with Mac Pro that are using them for music recording or graphics design, they are running old software programs. They're running old operating systems because they don't want to break what currently exists. And so they're the waiters. They're not in a hurry to upgrade. They'll wait until 2019, whereas there are some people who maybe their machine, maybe they're just excited and they want to try something new and different. The iMac Pro is definitely an option, but at the same time, for those Mac Pro users that need that Mac Pro spec, I think Jim has nailed it, that they're willing to wait for sure.
I also think Apple has benefited from Intel's laggard improvement of their chips, that even a late 2013 Mac Pro probably doesn't feel too slow compared to 5 years later, mostly because Intel hasn't really done that much to make their chips that much faster. I doubt there are many pros who are saying, oh man, I can't use this Xeon E5. It's just too slow compared to what I need. Nobody's saying that. In fact, I bet. What you do want, though, and what was missing in the trash can Mac Pro and is missing in the iMac Pro, is modularity. And that is the good news from Matthew Panzerino. Apple says it's going to be a modular Mac.
Andy was just saying, it depends on what you mean by modular and how modular. But if you look back to the Mac Pro, the silver one.
The cheese grater, we fondly call it.
Yes, cheese grater. I mean, I had a lot of PCI cards and things like that in there from companies like Universal Audio.
Right.
You can't
do that very easily. Although they have eGPU support now. In High Sierra. And I don't know if eGPU means you'll also have the ability to run those external cards on a PCI slot, external PCI slot.
Well, part of the problem now is that when Apple moved away from those things, all of these companies came out with external DSP to take the load off of the CPU, so that when you're running plugins, it doesn't tax the computer as much. It taxes what used to be the PCI card. But now is a piece of outboard gear that's sitting on your desktop or around the console.
Boger also says, there is absolutely a need in certain places for modularity. I'm sorry, I can't get off of my spin. But it's also really clear the iMac form factor of the MacBook Pros can be exceptionally good tools. I mean, okay, I guess I'm seeing it through, you know, a certain filter. I do think modularity is pretty important. But you make an excellent point. If modularity hasn't been available for 5 years, maybe everybody's moved on to the next thing. Andy?
It depends on how you want to define, as always, what does the word pro mean? For some, it might mean a specific workflow, a specific type of usage. For me, it's always meant we, the manufacturer, are not going to dictate to you how you must use this machine. We know that you will have very peculiar and specific needs, and we'll give you a platform that will let you make modifications or build a system that will really be focused to what you want to do. And historically, that fulfills a really wide range of users, not just the people who are doing pro audio, doing pro video, but also people who are have outgrown the needs of the level of a base level, let's say, iMac, a consumer-oriented iMac or consumer-oriented Mac Mini. They just need a little bit more oomph. They need more ports. They need a little bit more resources for these one-off projects that they are pounding their head against once or twice a year, as opposed to 12 months out of the year. That's what you're sort of buying. That's kind of what I think has marked the difference between, for instance, the MacBook Pro and the ordinary MacBook line. And that's always what I've sort of felt the desktop line to be as well. So my bigger worry would be that they really want to get such a specific data oriented idea of the typical Mac Pro user that they once again sort of lock you into a track where you don't want to have expansion cards. You want to put everything on an external bus instead for sound and for video. And we're going to let you do all that by buying all this other stuff, which again will work great for a lot of people who are making a lot of money with their Mac Pros. It won't do quite so well for people that, once again, they've outgrown the consumer grade, but they're not making a fortune off of contracts that they're fulfilling with their desktop system. So we're gonna have to wait and see what they really have in mind for us.
Yeah,
but I think those people that are in between, that's where the iMac Pro comes in. You know, because they do have a lot of the outboard gear where you plug into Thunderbolt or USB or whatever, and they can, if they need that extra power, they can still get it. I think the Mac Pro, especially in the modular design, is going to be for those high-end, very high-end professionals. And I think the power will show that, and most likely the price will show that as well. But it's going to be a high-end machine. So, yeah.
But once again, I'm only speaking personally, but I just don't have a use for an all-in-one machine. It just isn't how I tend to work. I like to have, I have a really nice monitor that I'm already screened that I'm very, very happy with. And I like being able to have it on an arm so I can position it anywhere. So I would be, if faced with the problem of I'm going to either have to spend money for a screen that I don't want and a form factor that isn't what I decree to be optimal for my use. Once again, it's a case of here's $3,000. You're going to have to adjust what you want to what we're willing to sell you. Which admittedly is always going to be a problem when you have a company that isn't going to license their designs to anyone else or let anybody else make Hackintoshes or stuff like that. But nonetheless, it's always going to be a problem that consumers are going to have to deal with as they continue to evolve as users.
Yeah, but I really don't think that you or even me, even recording what I do, are the market for a Mac Pro.
Yeah,
you know, the other machines are so powerful. You know, not even Leo sitting at his desk right now is probably not the market for the Mac Pro. However, the back end of what Leo does with all the streaming and everything else, that could be a market that they're looking at.
Oh, sure. So, although it's too late for it's too late for us. We bought Windows machines running Premiere. Because,
well, it's never too late, Leo. Just set fire.
We're not switching back. Unless Microsoft dumps the pro market, I don't think that's going to happen. Apple did in this meeting, which I'm again really have to say feels more like marketing than anything else. You know, here's the message. We said in the meeting that the pro community isn't one thing. It's very diverse. There are many different types of pros. We've said that, too. I think that's obvious. They go really deep into the hardware and software, pushing everything to its limit. We wanted our architects to sit with real customers to understand the real flow. But, of course, the challenge with that is that customers are typically responsive when Apple comes calling. It's not easy to get what they want because they're using proprietary content. You know, Apple's can't get access to the Pixar studios when they're working on the next movie. So what Apple did is they hired creatives and brought them into Apple. And there's something called the Pro Workflow Team, a bunch of artists, technicians working on, they say, real projects, and then using Apple hardware, in some cases prototype hardware, and certainly new versions of the software to bang on it and give Apple feedback on what it is that they need and where there are bottlenecks, where they need to improve things. And Apple was quick to point out that this Pro Workflow Team is sitting right next to the hardware design team that's working on the new Mac Pro. That's pretty encouraging. I think that's very good news. It means that they're
Sort of shout, "Hey, this isn't working right. Come fix this."
Right. Yeah. Right. But there are also higher level decisions that Apple needs to make, and I don't know if they're getting the kind of feedback they need. Things like OpenGL doesn't work on Macintoshes, either fix it or something. You know, I mean, there are issues. I wish, unfortunately, Alex Lindsay, who should really be sitting here for this conversation, it would be really better to talk to this, but I feel like there are decisions that aren't made at that granular level that need to be made at a higher level. Maybe Apple's getting the signals they need on those kinds of things as well. There's many ways that Apple hasn't treated professionals very well. Mm. We were talking about this on Twit with Brianna Wu, who's a game designer, and she said, you know, her specialty is OpenGL, and she said Apple's implementation is unusable.
Yeah, I thought that was a very encouraging sign too, that they're to the extent of hiring filmmakers to simply make films just so that Apple could watch them make films.
Right.
That shows a really huge sign of faith in the pro level of user. That's unusual, and that's certainly attention getting. My concern is that every time that I've thought that Apple has messed up personally, it's when they have. Is when they feel as though when people complain that, hey, you've built a machine that really doesn't work for me, or gee, this really isn't attractive, they instead point to, hey, look, but we have numbers that prove, we did so much testing that prove that this is exactly the Mac that you want. So obviously you just need to get used to it. And again, for the Mac Pro, I really think that there should be part of the Mac line that is, we are not going to insist that you adapt anything that you do to our way of to our method of manufacturing a Mac. We are going to give you something that's flexible enough that we can integrate into your office and to your job and into your creative goals, as opposed to you saying that you having to say that, well, I really didn't want this, but this is all you're offering, so this is what I'm going to have to buy.
I feel like Apple's pride got in the way. That if they had less pride, they would have just taken the old cheese grater Mac, updated it with new processors, newer bus. This wouldn't have been as complicated as designing a whole new Mac Pro. And said, yeah, we made a mistake. They admitted they made a mistake, but in 2 years, we're going to fix it. Yeah. Instead, they could have said, well, in 6 months, we're going to give you a cheese grater Mac as a stopgap, a modular Mac as a stopgap until we get the really great thing out in 2019.
Well, isn't that what they did with the iMac
Pro is, though?
No, but it's not. That's exactly not what the iMac Pro. The iMac Pro is a sealed box. And it requires people to buy EG. Look at this description
But it's something that they could rev and update and get on the market really, really quick without having to reinvent the entire.
Admittedly,
platform.
They could have done that with a cheese grater as well, right?
But then you're talking about a price point that's a little higher than maybe someone wants to invest in this year.
I spent $4,000 on an iMac Pro. Higher than that,
you could have spent
$3,000. Look at this. Listen to the description that Matthew gives of a situation of a kind of a workflow situation going on. An iMac Pro with two iPad Pros hooked up to it allows for direct control shortcuts and live access to the Logic Manual, all while you're mixing songs on the main device Oh, wait a minute, the iMac Pro? No, an eGPU with a MacBook Pro running a live edit of an 8K stream with color grading as effects apply. So Apple sold an iMac Pro, two iPad Pros, an eGPU, and a MacBook Pro to do this, when really a cheese grater could have probably handled it.
It couldn't have done the iPad stuff. That was something that really caught my attention. I've always, like, when the Touch Bar MacBook came out, my big complaint was that it really was just such weak sauce that if they really wanted to add touchscreen improvements to a Pro workflow, it would be just as simple as, oh, I see you have an iPhone. Would you like me to be able to cast some of the interface, like a control deck or a jog shuttle, onto your iPad or onto your iPhone? That's really interesting, and that's really cool. That's something that Adobe is doing with their Photoshop kit, where you can actually use a touchscreen device as part of a desktop interface. So that shows the sort of, we need 2 years to really figure this out thinking that I think is justified. Again, I agree with you. The only reason why you invite a reporter into the campus is for some sort of message that you hope that reporter is going to give to everybody else. So I do agree with that, but that doesn't change the fact that a lot of the things that they chose to say are things that leave me optimistic about what's coming in 2019. This is big thinking, as opposed to slap a better CPU and a better address bus into the cheese grater.
I think the workflow team is a perfect example of the potential that the new MacBook Pro or the new Mac Pro could have, and is that it potentially could fit all of our needs, because if they really are testing the waters with all different manner of users in all different situations, not everyone is going to buy a MacBook Pro, then buy two iPads, then hook up a GPU. But some are. Some don't will. Want a Mac Pro. Yeah. Some yeah. want that setup.
Right.
So if you're navigating all these testing situations using the MacBook Pro and two iPads and a GPU, but you're also doing it with this brand new Mac Pro, but you're also doing it with an iMac, I think this is a great idea and could potentially not only benefit the Mac Pro coming out, but what I read from this article was that I get the sense that Apple is working toward making all of the Mac line more user-friendly across the board, no matter what level you're at. That even a MacBook Air, if that have something a little more appealing to the people that would use a MacBook Air, so that their workflow is comfortable just as the way a Mac Pro user's workflow would be comfortable.
Well, I guess I'm just a mean old man. I really would have loved to have seen a cheese grater Mac. Doesn't keep them from doing this Mac Pro. But 2019 is 6 years after the release of the last Mac Pro. That's for any technology company, 6 years between models is a really long time. It's more than a lifetime. It's an eternity. And meanwhile, I have to also point out Apple, that your competitors across the aisle are pumping out new form factors, models, and ideas monthly. And there's plenty of companies like my company that finally just gave up and said, well, I guess we'll get a Dell.
Mm. Yeah, that's one thing that...
Just because they're pushing them out monthly doesn't mean it's the best thing.
Well, this is a pretty good thing. But I'm just saying, there's stuff out there that... that is pretty impressive, and the variety of the ecosystem and the breadth of the ecosystem in the Windows scene is something that is directly, in competition with Apple. Now, I understand Apple likes to work in a vacuum. In fact, it's really encouraging that they're bringing pros in. Although I doubt this is anything new. I'm sure that they've done this all along. But it's good that they're asking.
I haven't heard of a program this intense.
Yeah.
Again, such as convincing somebody to please stop working in your business, become an employee of Apple. Again, just basically to be, we're building our own leopard and gorilla pens. We're building our own captive zoo. We just want to be able to watch you cavort and gambol and romp and play,
right?
And take notes on your behavior. But yeah, I mean, but these are both really good points. It's just that there's no right or wrong between the way that the Windows ecosystem works and the way that the Mac ecosystem works. The thing is, if you buy Windows hardware, there's an excellent chance you're going to buy a piece of crap that was just pushed out because somebody in some rooms, some are thought that, hey, there's a market we're not attaching. So if we just make the model 238, the model 239/B, it does.
Well,
it,
if that's it, how it, you but, feel, but, you but, can but, then but, go the buy same, all no. the pieces and make your own Windows machine that is a killer. Because you can do that in the Windows side of the PC.
But most
side.
People aren't going to do same that.
Time. Lots of people do that. In fact, most pros do that.
But at the same time, Apple will not be able to sell you something that is exactly what you want. There's going to have to be, we make Model A, we make Model B. If you don't like either one of these, you're going to have to go elsewhere. Or you're going to have to, again, suffer a little as you adapt what you want. But you will always be getting stuff that at least has been extremely well thought out and is worth betting half of the product line on. So like you just that, have to, that, there's no right or wrong there.
I
there's
agree that that was the burnish on the Apple for a long time. And I think it's starting to fade. This also begs the question, well, what about that rumor? And admittedly, that's just a rumor that Apple's abandoning Intel the year after they put this thing out. How does that affect this?
Isn't that interesting? I still don't think that they'll be able to make to make a platform that is as powerful as even the iMac Pro that soon.
Not with ARM chips. Well, maybe they can. I don't know. They do some pretty good stuff.
It's not just building the hardware. It's also getting every single developer on board, making sure. I just don't see it. I'm not saying it's not.
Do you think it's possible that this development really is, and Matthew wouldn't necessarily have known, not on an Intel-based Mac Pro, but on an A15 or whatever Mac Pro?
Maybe.
It could be.
Maybe.
Could be, couldn't it?
This could be.
That might be the real reason why. They didn't do anything today because it would have been an Intel thing. A cheese grater update would have been an Intel thing. Let's get the A chips going, and maybe what they're really saying is that really the gating factor was that was we need a new chip platform. It's going to be ready in 2019 or 2020. Let's make the new Mac Pro be based on that. That would be very interesting, and would it kind of explain this long gap?
When I wrote about this about that rumor a couple of weeks ago, I did say that I could easily believe Apple seeing this as an opportunity to totally redo the Mac operating system. The UI has been kind of frumpy over the past 5 or 6 years. We're not seeing the sort of evolution other than bringing a few cut and paste features from iOS into macOS. And so if they were going to go to an entirely new CPU architecture, this would be a great time for them to say, okay, we're just going to not necessarily start from scratch with a Mac, but we're going to say that every single possible idea of things to change is now open. And so that would be consistent with them saying, we're just going to watch people use our products and build an operating system and a UI that suits the people that we're watching, as opposed to updating what we've been essentially doing since macOS 9.
What is not clear, and I wish Matthew had spoken to this, is whether this was Matthew's initiative, whether he reached out and said, hey, it was a year ago, let's see what you're up to, and Apple said, oh, okay. Or whether Apple invited him out of nowhere, hey, it's time to show you this. Because in the first case, I would say, oh, this is great. Matthew got some additional information that really is encouraging. In the second case, if it's Apple reached out and said, hey, come on in, let's show you. It feels a little more like a dog and pony show. It's on Apple's terms and on Apple's timing. That's not clear, and it makes it a little bit difficult to really judge this information.
Well, if we know anything from the way Apple works, it's most likely it was Apple's terms and Apple's conditions.
And so, Apple thought of this and said, let's bring Matthew back. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wish Matthew had said something. And the last thing at the end of the article that he says, and he's the guy, after all, who got the scoop, who got the story, and it's his impressions that are probably more important than somebody remotely. But the last thing he says, and I just apparently closed the article because I wanted to read his last thoughts. Here we go. Oh, I see. This is one of those infinitely scrolling pages.
Don't go too far.
I apparently reached the end of the internet by scrolling too far. Let me see if I can.
Can you show me where the end of the internet is?
I would love to see that. It's far, far away. As depressing as it has been to see professionals believe that Apple was ready to give them up, I find this an interesting and exciting thing to watch. It is very, very hard for a company like Apple, Matthew writes, whose reputation is built on myth building, to admit that it was mistaken. That's what it did last year. And it's even harder to then change course with billions of dollars worth of revenue at stake. I'm sure it gives a bunch of people at Apple heartburn, But it's fascinating for me because I don't have to pull it off. That's a good way to describe the challenge that's facing Apple right now. And I think that, we'll know more in June at WWDC. We'll know more next year if this Mac Pro comes out next year. We'll know more. I'd be fascinated and actually really encouraged to see Apple do something that isn't Intel, that really plays on its obvious expertise in chip design to make something that's better than Intel. Apple really has been let down by Intel, really, going back to my comments about the 2013 iMac or Mac Pro not being particularly out of date, at least in terms of the Intel chips.
I don't know. Scheduling,
I would love to see it.
Go ahead, Jim.
I'd love to see it.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are a lot of concerns and worries. You know, the biggest among them is the developers. Is there going to be a layer where, you know, current apps can continue to work with this chip? Can Apple pull that off again? They did it once.
Right.
But it did take some time to get developers over. And I mean, that transition could hurt.
That's why I think June will be interesting. I think they will. Don't you think they'll telegraph something? They need to get developers in line somehow.
It depends on how far out they are. I mean, if they're a couple of years out, no, maybe I don't think they will.
Yeah, it'd be too soon. We're going to take a break. By the way, as many of you know, those watching live, Mark Zuckerberg is testifying the first of 2 days of testimony before Congress. I have a little clip from that here. Let me just...
Mr. Zuckerberg, do I have your full attention?
No.
Do you think I deserve it?
What?
Do you think I deserve your full attention?
I had to swear an oath before we began this deposition, and I don't want to perjure myself, so I have a legal obligation to say no.
We'll come back with more in just a bit. Great panel. Really nice to have you here, Lori. You feeling a little more comfortable now?
Yes, thank you.
You fit right in. You fit right in. Lori Gill is Deputy Managing Editor at iMore. You hear her on the iMore Show, of course, and Appaholic on the Twitter. Jim Dalrymple from The Loop, loopinsight.com. The estimable beard. Always great to have you on. And, of course, Andy Inako, star of our show from Inako.com. Okay. Renee is taking the day off because he's going to get briefed on red iPhones. Well, what a life. He's not, Lori, he didn't fly to Cupertino for that, I hope.
No, this time I think he went to, I think he went to New York.
That's so ridiculous. What are they going to say? It's red.
He came to California last week.
I know.
And was in Chicago a few days before that. So he has not been home for weeks now. Dedication. And he'll be back out again for WWDC and maybe even before that. So
it's not easy covering Apple these days.
It's just too much.
You would think one company, it'd be easy, right? How hard could it be?
Yeah, no, I can't imagine. I wake up in the morning and Renee will have given me a notification of some kind of something coming up and I'm just mad at Apple.
I think honestly, Renee next time is going to cover IBM. It's a lot quieter. It's a lot calmer. Choose IBM.
Yeah, he can actually take a vacation.
Yeah, for years. Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Quicken Loans, number one lender in the country. Now, always number one in your hearts because, of course, number one in customer satisfaction year after year, according to J.D. Power. But number one in volume, too. They've become the biggest lender in the nation. And I have to credit a little bit of this to Rocket Mortgage. Quicken Loans realized a couple of years ago that the mortgage experience, the mortgage approval process really wasn't keeping up with the times. It was straight out of the 19th century, you know, going to a bank, filling out a long application, going to the attic, trying to find your pay stubs from 2012, stuff like that. They wanted a client-focused technological reinvention of the whole process, and they created Rocket Mortgage, an entirely online mortgage approval process. You could do the whole thing on your phone. It's fast too. It's so fast. You could go to an open house, say, "Hey, never before having thought this, we should buy this house." Go to Rocket Mortgage. It's rocketmortgage.com/MacBrag, and type in a few. You know, they ask you a couple of things you know already: your name, address, phone number, birth date. Then, because they have relationships with all the financial institutions, they say, "Can we go get some information?" You say, "Yes." They crunch the numbers based on income, assets, and credits. They analyze all the home loan options for which you qualify. And then they offer you those home loan options. You choose the rate. You choose the term, you choose the down payment, you're approved. And that entire process, you didn't have to get up from the couch. You didn't have to leave the open house. It took less than 10 minutes. RocketMortgage.com/MacBreak. You'll apply simply. Couldn't be simpler. You'll understand every step of the way exactly what's happening. They're totally transparent. And then you'll mortgage with confidence. Rocket Mortgage. To get started, go to RocketMortgage.com/MacBreak. RocketMortgage.com/MacBreak. This is the only way to do it. Refis, too, by the way, with interest rates going up, this is a good time to check them out for their refi rates. Get started now, and you'll be ready when that house hits you. RocketMortgage.com/MacBreak. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. And MLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. I hope the house doesn't hit you. That's straight out of The Wizard of Oz, isn't it? RocketMortgage.com/MacBreak. How is Zuck doing in the testimony? Is he's got a necktie on. That's good. Have they been spanking him? Seriously, I think that's kind of, if you read the name of the hearing, it sounds like they're kind of going after him.
That seems like a totally different show.
It doesn't seem like the Apple show, does it? Actually, it is the Apple show in one respect, Jim. All of this attention, and boy, every day there's more news about how Facebook leaked information. And, you know, I just saw a story that said Cambridge Analytica, only a handful of people took their quiz in Australia, but they got information in almost the whole country because of the way Facebook handled it. That kind of thing just really helps Apple. It helps Apple's privacy story, right, Jim?
Sure it does. And Apple's been very clear on how they feel about privacy for years. This isn't anything new that came up because how Facebook handled this. This is an advantage that Apple has in the market.
Although one could say, we were talking about this on Sunday on Twit, one could say that Apple kind of stumbled into this because iAds didn't work, so they really didn't need the advertising information. Ping and eWorld, whatever the other Apple social networks they've tried, none of them were successes, so it never was really on the table for Apple to steal your information. So might as well make a virtue out of it and say, oh, we care about your privacy.
Certainly, well, that's not necessarily true. They could have looked at your iMessages. They could have made the operating system more open so that they could track what you do and where you go and things that you say. But all of that stuff is closed off. So, they had lots of opportunities, not just with iAds, to harvest data from its users, and it chose not to. Yeah. And I think that was the right decision.
Yeah. In fact, somebody in the chat was pointing out that even in 2010, Jobs was concerned about Facebook's business model and warned about privacy issues. This is from CNN at the Wall Street Journal. Conference. It's a video of Jobs discussing privacy issues. Privacy, and this is 2010, it's 8 years ago. Privacy, Jobs said, means people know what they're signing up for in plain English and repeatedly. I believe people are smart and some people want to share more data than other people do, but ask them. Ask them every time. Make them tell you to stop asking them if they get tired of your asking them. Let them know precisely what you're going to do with their data. I tell you what, that's exactly what Facebook should have done. And it's what Apple does to this day. I was talking about this with my wife, Lisa, because we were talking about how location information could really leak stuff that you don't even think about. There was a story last Thanksgiving about how families with different political opinions were getting together for Thanksgiving. And I was wondering, well, how do they know that? And it turns out the company that mined this data did it from people's smartphones. They would see when you were with a family member on Thanksgiving Day, and then based on the information from Facebook about what political affiliation everybody in the household had, they could write this article. And all of this was information leaked out of Facebook and the phone. And I said, and we were talking about it, and I said, that's why you should use an iPhone, because even after you give an app permission, the iPhone will ask you again, hey, you know, this app still is tracking you. Do you want that? Plus, apps aren't allowed to share information with other apps. I mean, I think Apple has it right, and they've done it right.
Whether they agree.
I think that
go ahead.
There's something to be said for this sort of shared shared data that you're talking about that is the most dangerous, that individually companies may not be able to collect enough data about you that kind of moves into creepy territory. But once one company shares that data with another company and shares that data with another company, now you're looking at the ability to recreate your entire life right in front of your eyes. And then we're getting into the Matrix thing here, where are we doing things because the internet tells us to do them, or have we made these decisions on our own? And it kind of puts you into a cycle that goes deeper and deeper when all this information about you is being shared and then sold back to you in one form or another.
Yeah.
I really do think that we need federal laws similar to what's happening in the EU right now, that just protects personal data from being used in a way that the user never explicitly approved of. It's just insane when you realize that you live in a world in which there is actually a profitable business model to just simply equip cars with license plate scanners and simply have them drive around parking lots and drive around residential streets just to collect information on what cars are where at what time. And then that bit of information is so hugely valuable that it's worth putting those cars on the road and paying people to drive round and round and round. It's insane to think that the next time I have a car, one of the first user added options is going to be a little curtain that I deploy every time I park it to make sure you can't read my license tags just by simply driving past it. We need protection for consumers.
It's more than just that. We need to be able to say what people can and can't do with our data. It's that we need to know what they're doing. That's the biggest problem, is that these companies, they're gleaning all of this information from us, and they're not telling us what they're taking from us. And I think the transparency of everything that you're taking from me, I should be able to easily find out about and decide for myself whether or not I want to continue to let that happen. Just like maybe I'm willing to let a company take a picture of my license plate and follow me around, but I need to know that that's happening so that I can make that choice as a consumer. I think that's been the problem all along, is that the transparency of what these companies are collecting from us hasn't been good enough. We don't understand what data is being taken from us in order to make proper decisions for ourselves.
I think it's also important to point out that people often willingly give up their private information. You tell somebody that, you know, you'll give them a $5 coupon at Walmart and just fill out this form, and people will go fill it out. You know,
I do it all the time. Google has a thing on Android called Google Surveys, where they ask the most private personal details. I do it because you get credit in the Google Play Store. And it's kind of funny because they'll say, well, where were you last night? And you tell them, and here's 25 cents. But I don't. So you're right, Jim. And that's, I think, was Jobs' point. Give them let them know you're doing it. Give them the choice. And keep them saying, do you want to?
I mean,
do
most
this?
People don't equate that with their privacy.
Right.
They'll just say, oh, I get $5 for you know, filling out this form. And then the next time you get, here's a $10 one.
Don't you think they should be allowed to do that?
Well, I, you know.
If I want my Google Play credit and they ask me, you know, where I was, and I say, okay, I think that's fair. You think that should be prohibited?
No, I'm not saying it should be prohibited, but I'm saying a lot of the people that are yelling about their privacy
are already giving it up.
Are already giving it up, you know, for a few bucks.
Yeah.
So it's hard to yell about privacy unless you actually care about your privacy.
I don't care much about my privacy, obviously, but I do very much care about Facebook not being upfront about what they're gathering and who they're giving it to.
Yeah,
I care a lot about that.
See, that my difficulty is that we already have companies that claim to be complying with certain regulations and rules of fairness by saying, "Oh, well, no, that user did give us permission to track their phones and collect information on all of their friends, because remember we had a new piece of software that said we have new terms of service. Click OK if you accept them without reading them." What I'm getting on about is that I think that the situation has become so uncontrollable that we need an identification of a fundamental right to ownership of your personal information. That if you that at best, when I click that button, I'm just leasing this information to Facebook or whatever marketer has is observing my web traffic. That if I want to, I can simply say, by the way, I don't like how, what you're doing with my data. I'm now terminating your license to use this data. And now if they violate that those services, there are going to be treble or quintuple damages, something that will really, really make them feel a lot of pain. It's like this is why it's such a long and complicated conversation to have. Whenever I get in discussions, even on a personal level, about, oh, well, I don't like Facebook and I don't like Google, but I trust Apple, but I don't like this company. It's like Apple feels as a core value. I truly believe this, that privacy is something that is important and valuable to consumers, and something that they don't want to violate. It's part of the compact that they're making with users, and they don't want to violate it. I believe that that's part of their core values. However, you can spend as much time as you want in the Apple ecosystem. As soon as you go into a grocery store and pay for something with a credit card, okay, you've just compromised your privacy. As soon as you've hit any website anywhere without using a really good ad tracker, ad blocker, and cookie blocker, again, you're compromised. It's like saying that you're living in the smog-filled, filthy environs of London in 1891, but you wash your hands. It's like, again, it's better that you're washing your hands instead of not, but you are still living in a toxic environment that you need to be protected from, and it's not something that's going to happen because of voluntary things that industry does or good practices that individuals do. It's going to have to be laws passed to say that this is not right. Our citizens deserve better than this, and this is going to be a much worse situation before it gets better.
You know, I think if we actually knew all of the information that companies have on us, it would probably scare us to death.
That's been interesting, because ever since Facebook offered, as a result of GDPR, the ability to download all the things it knew about you, that's when all of this stuff has started coming out. For instance, the fact that Facebook Messenger on Android, they couldn't do it on iPhone for a couple of years because Android's permissions were lax, was downloading everybody you'd called, how long you talked to them, and uploading it to Facebook. And when people realized that, because they were able to download the data, they were horrified. But that's the point, is I think this stuff, somebody's saying, the Beatmaster in the chat room is saying, but Leo, none of you are private people by virtue of the fact that we're all sitting here on camera talking about stuff. but I don't think you have to be somebody who embraces total privacy to care about privacy. I mean, I mean, I'm a public person and I don't mind being public, but I still want to know. And what I really don't like is when companies are kind of sneakily taking this data and giving it to other companies and not disclosing. Now, Apple's going to be in a different boat soon, though. One of the reasons Apple could do this was because Apple sold hardware. Facebook and Google are advertising platforms. Amazon somewhat, too, these days. And as a result, when you're an advertising platform, I know because we're an advertising platform, there's intense pressure from advertisers. Give us everything you could possibly tell us about your customers. We intentionally don't collect data, and the way we solve that is being a hyper niche product, and we feel like, and it has been so far, adequate for advertisers. Hey, if you want early adopters, if you want influencers, if you want tech enthusiasts, that's what you're going to get. We don't tell them more than that. We don't know more than that. But Facebook wants to give a broad general advertising industry lots of information and lots of granularity. So does Google. So there's huge incentive, pressure even, for them to do this. But Apple's business model is changing. They sell hardware, but watch as services grow and become more and more of their business, and as Siri becomes more and more part in their business, that's when the rubber's going to hit the road, where Apple's commitment to privacy, that's where we really want to test it. They just hired, for instance, Google's former head of search and AI, John Giandrea. And Tim Cook had to say, John shares our commitment. Don't worry. John shares our commitment to privacy and our thoughtful approaches. We make computers even smarter and more personal. I mean, I imagine some Apple people would be a little bit concerned when the guy who designs AI and search for Google comes over to Apple. I think it's a big score. I think it'll help Siri. But for Siri to really become good, it needs to kind of know more about you, doesn't it?
Yeah, and how much more is it going to collect from us? That's kind of been Apple's point of view, is that, yeah, Siri's not that great, but you know what? Siri doesn't store things that it shouldn't.
Right.
It doesn't know anything. So this sort of idea that, like, we're making Siri better, maybe because we're going to store some things that we weren't going to store before. And that really does lead down a very frightening path. If we're kind of all in this boat of Apple's so great and I trust them with my privacy, and if they are walking down a path that potentially exposes our privacy in some way that we're not used to Apple doing, that really is a huge change from what we've been so kind of wonderfully championing about the company for so long.
Yeah.
I don't think that they'll do that, though.
Right. You don't think Apple will do that, but that doesn't mean that they can't and wouldn't possibly have the potential to. I mean, I agree. I don't think Apple would do that, but Tim Cook isn't going to be the CEO of Apple for 100 million years. Right. Things change. What's going to happen in the future?
Well, that's my point exactly, Lori. And so it's just our job to keep an eye on it. That's all. And to the degree we can. The thing that really bugged me about Facebook is it was so opaque. There was no way of knowing. I mean, we could have guessed, but really there was no way of knowing how lackadaisical they were being with privacy protections. We now know that. Android was being extremely lackadaisical with privacy protections. They have since tightened up those privacy and controls so that that thing Facebook did a few years ago can't be done on current versions of Android.
Yeah, I think so long as people have the ability to, like we've been saying, control, access, understand the transactions that they're making, it's okay, because this really is all about transactions. We make transactions with Apple because we trust them. I make transactions with Google because I believe that what I'm getting from them is worth what I'm giving them, and I also believe that they take seriously within the limits of their business model the need to maintain my privacy. Facebook, I do believe that just as again core value of the company is that everything is meant to be shared. That people get drawn closer together the more information is free floating out there. And I don't believe that there are a lot of internal breaks against saying, no, we should not collect this, or no, it would be wrong for us to observe this.
Oh, sorry. I turned on Mark Zuckerberg briefly. Go ahead. Keep talking. I just like seeing his sweaty visage.
That's cool. I was making such a pervasive argument that Zuck interrupted me to talk over me. That was wonderful. I feel very flattered.
You want to hear what he's saying?
No.
What are you saying, Mark?
Okay. Do you think that during
Senator Maria Cantwell
2016 campaign,
questioning
as Cambridge Zuckerberg. Analytica was providing support to the Trump campaign under Project Alamo, were there any Facebook people involved in that sharing of technique and information?
Senator, we provided support to the Trump campaign similar to what we provide to any advertiser or campaign who asks for it.
So that was a yes. Is that a yes?
Senator, can you repeat the specific question?
I'm just glad that they've trained him to blink every few seconds now. I think that's.
I don't envy Zuckerberg.
Oh, can
today.
You, Matt? You want to see some terrifying pictures? There's a picture on Twitter of Zuckerberg sitting at the table all alone, surrounded by about 100 pool photographers, just right in his face taking pictures. And
it's a much smaller room than you think it is. The senators and the Congress people are about 10 or 12 feet away from you. It's a bad feeling when they're not there to give you a medal of some sort.
They did I understand over the weekend spend time training Mark. You're kind of like you would train for a political campaign debate, where they had surrogates and they had pestered him with questions and put him in all. So he really has actually had quite a bit of training. I imagine, given their resources, Facebook built a room exactly like the Senate chamber and exactly to the T. Yep. But you know what is going to be happening, which is, I kind of feel bad for Mark, is the pile on, because this is an opportunity for every senator to get some camera time showing how strongly they're committed to protecting the public. And so this ends up being like stump speech after stump speech after stump speech. It's really kind of.
Yeah. Well, this is a big problem for Facebook, because if right now the power of the internet has always been the presumption that we can't, that government shouldn't really limit what people can do or say. They can only respond when bad things happen. And that's one of the reasons why, for instance, the basic principle of like YouTube, that applies to YouTube, is that it's not Google's responsibility to prevent somebody from posting copyrighted content on the service illegally. It's just their responsibility to take it down once the copyright holder notices that this has happened. So if the Facebook is kind of doomed, if now they're responsible for vetting every single ad that comes on board and every single piece of communication that comes on board, and in the head of the 2018 election cycle, where there's a lot of deeply, deeply contested seats, this could be very, very bad, not only for Facebook, but if they decide to put the hammer down on the entire industry, it could be bad for Google as well. Apple, it's a good day to be Tim Cook, because there are a lot of ways this could shake out. None of them would be bad for Apple.
Yeah. And to your point, Laurie, I mean, Apple could change their tune, but they're watching this and saying, okay, bullet dodged. Let's just make sure we stay on the straight and narrow here. How does Siri get better, though, if Apple wants to preserve privacy? Is there a way forward for Siri?
Who wants to take this one?
Apple, Laurie doesn't know. Okay.
That's kind of the problem, is that there's got to be a way, right? But there's something to be said for how well other virtual assistants work. The Google one and the Amazon one, they work better than Siri. I'm sorry, they do.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I know why. It's because they're able to collect and store. It's like if you had a personal assistant that you used a memory charm on at the end of every day and took away that personal assistant's memories, so that they had to start over from scratch every time they wanted information there, or you had to give them information. So how can Apple protect my privacy while making Siri better? That's the question, right?
I'm not sure there's
an answer.
So you could at least make Siri smarter about the outside world. It doesn't need to know my flight schedule or
I agree.
When I go to bed, but it could know more about hotels and flights and other things. Go ahead, Jim.
There is something to be said for your point. I asked Siri yesterday, when did the NHL playoffs start? And Siri had no idea.
Right.
The playoffs start tomorrow, by the way.
See, Google would know that you were Canadian and have that ready.
So Google did
voice
know,
print analysis.
Yeah. Because 40% of hoots. I have the Google app on my iPhone, and whenever Siri can't answer something, I try Google just to see.
Right.
And Google did know. But I mean, that's one of those things where when I wrote an article a little while ago about our expectations of Siri and how Siri seems to work better on some devices as opposed to others. And my theory in writing this was that a lot of it is based on our expectations. So, for instance, CarPlay, Siri works wonderful in CarPlay. It works great on the HomePod. But our expectations of what Siri can do for us in those two devices is so limited that it appears that Siri is working really well. And in fact, it does work really well. When I hop in the car, I'll ask it to read a text for me. I'll get directions and I'll play music. So there's three things that I do in the car with CarPlay, but nothing else. So if you go then to your phone, what are your expectations for the phone? Well, they're really, Apple hasn't set any expectations, so it's wide open. So we're asking Siri all kinds of different things, to do things, to answer questions that for some reason it's not able to do. And it appears that Siri is not working very well on the iPhone, but our expectations are so different and so wide-ranging on the iPhone as opposed to the other devices.
Right.
So, is the problem, yes, that Siri can't answer when the NHL playoffs are, even when they're 2 days away? Or is the problem that we shouldn't be asking Siri that? Well, as Laurie said, some of the other assistants can answer those questions. So why can't Siri? I'm not asking it about my anything to do with my personal information. I'm asking Siri an outside question. You know, this seems like a very simple question. I can ask Siri music questions. And
another Siri frustrating, a frustrating part about Siri is that you can ask Siri whether or not the, or when the NHL playoffs are, or the season starts, and it'll answer it wrong the first time. And if you ask it again, it'll answer it right. For me, the most frustrating aspect of Siri is that it sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. That's just crushing to me. I want it to always work or always not work, not sometimes turn my lights on and then sometimes tell me it doesn't know what I'm asking. And I think that's even more frustrating that that Siri might not know when a sports playoff starts, but I bet if you asked it again, it would have the answer, even if you asked it in the same way. And that's super frustrating.
It's kind of a shame Facebook decided to postpone its assistant. I bet it'd be really good.
Oh, I think it would be the first proactive assistant that says,
"Yeah,
have you thought about voting for this guy?
How would you like to learn Russian?
This would get to that point where our personal assistant would get a crush on us and then try to kill our partners and trap us in
like
the bathroom.
Fun. Yeah, no, I'm ready for Scarlett Johansson and her. I want, and I don't care if she goes off with the other AIs at the end. It's okay. It's okay.
Apple did make a big point a year or two ago. I think it was a year ago about their investment in differential privacy, which is a concept in research that says there's a way to get the benefit to the user of personal information without necessarily actually storing or relating personal information to any one specific user. And that's a much bigger field than I just made it sound. So they've got a dog in that game. But the big problem is that it's, you know, just like you said, it's people don't use anything if it doesn't work the way they expect it to. And I think one of the biggest problems of personal assistants is that people will only use it to find out what the weather is and to set a kitchen timer if that's all that it can actually do reliably.
Right. They never try anything else,
And then part of that transaction that I was speaking about Google is that I have no doubts that it's that we're not too far away from my being able to, as I'm getting dressed and thinking that I'm either going to just make my commuter train or I'm just going to miss it. I don't know whether I should drive or take my bike or whatever. And being able to say, hey, Guillermo, are the trains running late today? And I'm perfectly fine with it knowing that it knows where I am. So it knows we're talking about the MBTA. It knows what my usual train is on what line. So it knows, and it knows where I generally pick up the train from. So if it's going to say that, yes, the red line is running about 11 minutes late during to track activity, Amtrak activity outside of South Station, then I'm like, okay, thank goodness, I'm not going to miss my train. That's the sort of stuff that people are, if you give me a benefit that exceeds the value of the information I'm giving you, that's perfectly fine. I love the fact that when I'm on a business trip, I just swipe left and my hotel information is there. My flight information is there. Traffic conditions from the airport to my hotel is there. Everything has been collected for me. And again, it's an okay transaction. That's why I keep using these Google services. Siri, even when and remember that I am also an equal like iOS user. I just don't use it because it just doesn't work. And it doesn't give me the sort of depth of information that I think is valuable apart from what's the weather right now and set a kitchen timer for 20 minutes.
And you can't really blame that for Apple's privacy policies for that. On the other hand, I should say that even though Siri is not leading the pack, even the best of them fails frequently enough that you have not a whole lot of confidence that these. I mean, we're really in the primitive stages of this stuff.
Yeah, but Siri is at it's a marvelous piece of software. The people who work on it are doing marvelous things. But between Amazon's product, Google's product, and Apple's product, if you think about which one is most likely when you say call mom to say dialing mom's diner in Chichewick, Massachusetts, I think that most people think that would probably be Siri that would make that
mistake. The first one. Yeah. Actually, sometimes it's kind of humorous. I like to talk to Siri just because she's wacky.
Of course, that's why you like to talk to us.
Yeah, definitely why I like to talk to you, Jim. Lots of Twitter memes already about Mark Zuckerberg and and his testimony in front of Congress. This is going to be an interesting couple of days. We're not a breaking news network, so most of the time, unless it's an Apple event, so we probably won't cover this live. But as if anything big happens, we'll let you know. Having some fun with Lori Gill from iMore.com. She's deputy managing editor there. Appaholic, APPAHOLIK on Twitter.
And someday I will get my name back from Twitter. I had it once long ago and got rid of it like a fool. And somebody else picked it up.
I almost did that. You know, I registered for Twitter in December 2006, got fed up with Twitter in March, quit. I was just lucky that when I came back a few months later, my name was still there.
Yeah, I had the exact opposite experience. Yeah. When I was fed up and quit, it was gone by the time I came back.
Did you have L-O-R-R-Y?
Yep, it was L-O-R-Y-G-I-L.
The whole name. And somebody took that?
Yep, it was my name. Perfect, yeah. And the worst part is that whomever owns it is sitting on it. It hasn't actually been tweeted from in years.
I'm hoping you'll come pay them lots of money.
That's probably true.
Yeah.
I know.
Andy Inoko, Chicago. Formerly Chicago Sun-Times, now Inoko.com. Great stuff in Fast Company lately. They're showing some good taste using your freelance services, I must say. And from The Loop. The Loop Insight, loopinsight.com, Jim Dalrymple. He's JDALRYMPLE on Twitter. Our show today brought to you by my saliva. That's all it took to get my 23andMe reports. I say that because I think sometimes people think when I'm talking about 23andMe, which is a great service. I love it. Personal genetics service that lets you find out what your DNA story is. Some of the people, when I say that, they think, oh, you have to go to a doctor or get blood draws. No, they send you a little kit with a little tiny vial that you spit into, and your saliva contains enough of your DNA that they can get you the reports. They can do the analysis. Those 23 pairs of chromosomes, one set from your mom, one set from your dad, that make you uniquely you. There's so much in there about your ancestry, about your traits, about your health. For a long time, I'll give you an example. I've done it. I did it years ago. Lisa, my wife's done it. I gave it this Christmas to my mom and my sister. They're having such fun with it. For the longest time, I've known that my wife was what they call a super taster. I thought anyway. She was, because I would put ingredients in food, or we'd go to a restaurant and she'd say, oh, yeah, there's a little vinegar in there. I'd say, no, there's not. She said, you know, I can taste the sour cream that's in there. And I'd say, no, it's not. And she'd always be right. So I realized she must be a super taster. Well, we got her ancestry report, or her trait report back a couple of months ago. Actually, she was looking last week. Said 67% chance you're a super taster. That's kind of cool to find that stuff. I know. You find out weird stuff too, like whether you're more prone to having back hair or a cleft chin. You also got ancestry stuff that's really neat. She was curious. I guess she went. She was going to see if she had any Jewish ancestry, because her maiden name is Rosenthal. And sure enough, I think like 3% Ashkenazi Jew was in there. She has more Neanderthal than I do. I was very proud of that. I'm about 4% Neanderthal. I know. Isn't that cool? That's an example of how you get more all the time from 23andMe. When I did it, they didn't think at the time that Homo sapiens had interbred with Neanderthals. And then, not so long ago, a few years ago, they found some Neanderthal remains, and they were able to get a DNA analysis, and whoa, it turns out there was interbreeding. But that was something when I first did 23andMe that nobody knew about, and then since I've gotten the report. So they are always adding. You're always learning more. You could find out where your people came from, not just hundreds of years ago, but tens of thousands of years ago. You can actually watch the migration of your maternal and paternal haplogroups. Mine started in Africa, then I migrated up through the Middle East into Europe. It's really fun. They've got a DNA relative finder tool. With your permission and the permissions of the relatives, you can connect. I found a second cousin. It's actually kind of funny. I
I told my sister, oh, look, we have a second cousin. And I think it must be a second cousin because his last name's the same as grandma's maiden name. My sister said, you know Anthony. We have pictures of him. Oh, I just forgot, I guess. I was so excited. Look, I found a second cousin. I have other relatives I've found. It's really, really cool. Buy your 23andMe kit today at 23. That's the number 23andme.com/twit. 23andme.com/twit. Frankly, the most fascinating book ever written. The story of you. Sweet versus salty. Lactose intolerance. All sorts of stuff. 23andme.com/twit. Everybody in my family's done it. It's actually fun when you get everybody doing it.
It's you really see, funny. Honey, I've got a proof here that you're the one who snores.
Uh-huh.
72% predilection towards snoring and then waking up their husband during the night.
Yes.
Or it's a little uncomfortable when that one family member's DNA results are completely different than everyone else's and you have to explain that.
Actually, somebody told me about this. I think he DM'd me on Twitter. It's somebody I've known for some time. He said, you got to be careful. We did not know my sister was adopted.
Wow.
Funny thing from my report, 13% Charles Manson.
No, they don't.
They did not know that.
There's no genetic trait for Charles Manson.
As you laugh nervously.
Stay there, Andy. Stay there. Let's see. What other stories are big and burbling in the Apple world today? We mentioned Apple gets, by the way, a very good grade in its gender pay scorecard. Well, very good grade relative to other Silicon Valley companies. A- for Apple. Facebook, a failing grade. Apple got the highest ratings of all. Up there with Bank of New York, Mellon, eBay, JP Morgan, Nike, and Starbucks. But Apple was, these were all A-. Adobe B. Let's see where Google falls on this list. Well, it doesn't fall on this list at all. That's because Google doesn't give up this information. Alphabet. Where is it?
Alphabet.
Oh, look under Alphabet. Oh, it got a B. Hey, nice. All right. I take it back.
Let's see what Congress's score is.
Whoops.
A little bit lower than that.
Although, congratulations to Tammy Duckworth, who became the first sitting member of Congress, first senator, to have a baby while in office. She just had her baby. Isn't that great? 11 companies, including Facebook, Oracle, and HP, all failing grades on gender neutrality? Gender pay, actually, equal pay.
Yeah.
So it's not how many women work there. It's how the pay works out.
Right. So then that kind of calls into question a lot of other things of what exactly is this scorecard about? I think it's great to see the equality in pay. But, you know, if you have seven women working at your company and they happen to make the same amount of money as the seven men or is the 500 men in the same category, I'm not sure that's a comfortable environment for women to work in anyway. So it's great to see it, but it doesn't really give us any information about the company's gender equalities that's really out there. So, you know, with this particular report, I kind of take it all with a grain of salt. I appreciate that there's a lot of companies that are trying to get equal pay for women on a better scale. But at the same time, you know, if Oracle is hiring, you know, tens of thousands of women and the workforce is equal men and women on the workforce and they're, you know, they're doing worse on pay scale. They're employing tens of thousands of women instead of only seven. So
that's a good point, which I mean, you shouldn't have to pick one or the other. Obviously, you should have equal pay and gender diversity. But it sounds like you're saying gender diversity might be more important if you really don't hire women.
I think
You need both.
Being a woman.
Yeah. You've been there.
When I'm in environments where I'm the only woman, and I do see that a lot. I'm in a band, so I'm in the music scene, and the scene circles that I run in are dominated by men. My band is somewhat popular in my local area, but I feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It kind of doesn't matter to me that I'm on equal footing with the other men that play music in my scene, because I'm one woman in a crowd of hundreds. And you know, yes, equal pay is a great thing, but it's also, it needs to be taken in consideration how we feel about the environment that we're working in. And if there's women that don't feel safe or comfortable, or just don't feel like they are an equal in a work environment where they're dominated by men, even if their pay is equal or higher, there's something to be said for the cultural kind of vibe that goes on.
I don't know what the proportion of engineers at Apple are female, but Apple, I think, has pretty good gender representation across all the fields.
I can't remember the report, but they do. There's been multiple reports that have kind of addressed Apple's determination to be a more diverse and equal opportunity company. So we know that specifically about Apple, but we're also, you know, there's a long list here, or actually it's not that long. What is there, 23 or 33 companies? I don't know the details of the rest of the companies. Yeah. I can speak to the information I know about Apple, which it does seem like they're trying, but is Google trying as hard as Apple? Is Starbucks trying as hard as Apple? You know, I don't know. This information is only based on pay scale for the employees that are there. So
Apple did a diversity and inclusion report last year. They said 29% of the leadership at Apple was female. That's lower than it ought to be, but it is an increase of 1 point year over year. 39% of leaders under 30 are women, so that shows that more diversity is on its way. 50% of the new hires are from underrepresented groups in tech. That doesn't just include women. It includes African Americans, Hispanic, Native American, and Native Hawaiian and other Pacific Islanders. So you know what? This is one thing. If nothing else, you've got to credit Tim Cook with really working hard to make sure that Apple is a diverse workforce, is a compassionate workforce, and that Apple itself is a compassionate company. I think he's really done a good job of that.
And there's also something to be said for this sort of education project that Apple is taking on, that they're trying to get children involved. And somebody my age, women my age, didn't have the same opportunities to get into tech, or we're not encouraged by people older than us to get into tech. And now that has changed completely. And I think coding and education is a great opportunity to get young girls excited about science and math and computers. And then as they get older, they start thinking of those as possible career moves. Whereas, you know, people my age, that wasn't even a thing. The only guys in basements were getting jobs in the tech world, you know. And I think there's two steps. Step one, make your company welcoming for women to be in. And step two, teach our children that it doesn't matter what your gender identity is, that you're welcome to this industry. And I think as generations move on, we're going to see a lot more diversity in companies, especially the ones that have been starting now or starting before now, to get more diversity in their organizations.
Apple, according to its report from last year, in the tech sector, the tech fields, the tech jobs at Apple, 77% male. So there's the problem right there. It is up a little bit over the last few years, but not by much. It really is a male-dominated field. We've got to change that, because I'll tell you what, it makes a big difference in the quality and the variety of software that you get and so forth. You know,
it's just a better. Really, I don't know why anybody would not want that.
Yeah,
you know, there's very little that's as disappointing as a user of a certain company's products to find out that they have this culture of simply accepting not only lack of diversity, but lack of opportunity. Google is facing a bunch of class action suits related to gender gaps. They're not all related to pay. One of them is as caustic as two engineers with the exact same experience, exact same background. The male engineer is being hired into a track that could lead that person into becoming higher management or even senior executives, whereas the female engineer is being hired into a track that sort of limits them at a customer service role or at an emergency response role. So I love it when a company is smart enough and bold enough to say we're going to make all of our numbers visible about what the composition of our executive team is like, of our tech team is like, of all of our teams are like, because it's not just a PR thing to tell people like me and people like us. It also tells people inside their own organization where the faults lie and where the strengths are. It also tells people that are considering working for these companies where the faults are and where the problems are and what kind of environment they're getting into. You really do perceive it as this is an institutional problem. It's not, well, thank goodness they fired that one person who was responsible for all the sexism. It's no, you have a culture that says it's pretty much okay to basically limit the world of tech to just white dudes.
I agree wholeheartedly. I think it's the transparency and the efforts of all companies. I mean, this has to be important to everybody, and I'm glad to see it.
What band? What do you? What kind of music do you play, Lori?
pretty fast and thrashy stuff. It's like 80s nice. American hardcore kind of stuff. So yeah, pretty close.
and what do you play?
I did get to do a cover show recently where I got to be, I got to play bass for an MC5 cover show. So that was really fun.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Yeah. MC5 songs are so fun to play.
Wow. That's awesome. Are they fast?
Not really. They're just real grooving. And you get to kind of stay on the same notes for a long time while the guitarist just kind of wails away. So
you're a bassist.
I mostly sing, but I can play bass. I'm not great at it, but I can. Yeah.
I don't want to invade your privacy. Do you want to tell us the name of the band or?
I'm in quite a few bands. So Rad. RAD is the band that's kind of the most popular, the one that you can Google search and easily find. Nice. Although you have to use the word band and Sacramento because rad is such a general word.
Yeah.
That's us.
There you go.
Nice. I recently just started in Sacramento Records. I'm co-founder with a friend of mine. We run that record label together.
Oh, that's neat. So. You have a record label.
Yeah. It's not very big. We put out a record every couple of years because we're just doing it ourselves just for the love of the music. We try to keep it local and keep only Sacramento related bands. We put out so that, we kind of share our love of music, our love of the Sacramento music scene with everybody.
Very cool.
Was that you singing there and that page that was on the screen?
She was singing loud and fast.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, yeah, that's me. Yeah. The picture of this our most recent split 7-inch, so that means that we're sharing time with another band. So we're on one side of a 45 record and they're on the other side of a 45 record. We call them 7-inches in the punk rock world. the reason that that 7-inch happened is because somebody took a picture of me screaming into the microphone. That's it. That's a friend of mine who is a drummer in the other band.
She looks
on the other
scared.
Side. Yeah. So we made this record because of that song, The Croissants, which is, she's the drummer for The Croissants. The whole thing happened because of that picture, which I thought was hilarious.
You know, it's funny, but it kind of reminds me of a picture I took in the Galapagos. It looks very, very similar.
Yeah, that's about me right there.
Yeah, that's a seal yelling at a flightless cormorant, but it looks exactly like Lori.
That's yelling the cover at your first 10-inch.
Yep. Oh, definitely, definitely.
Oh my God, I love it. Well, it's nice to have two musicians.
I know, Jim. You and I should get together and jam out.
No kidding.
I know, right?
And Andy and I'll just go watch TV. Speaking of which, big news in the Apple world. Apple, you know, we've been talking, this is really interesting what's happening in the world of, you know, peak television. We talked yesterday about Amazon spending, what was it, $250 million to get the Lord of the Rings TV show, and they've committed to 5 years, five seasons of this, at roughly $1 billion. Apple has snagged a TV adaptation of Isaac Asimov's great science fiction series, Foundation, which seems to have an infinite number of books in it, by the way. There are many Foundation stories, but that would be a if it's done well, it will be headed by David S. Goyer. He's the guy who did Blade, Batman Begins, and The Dark Knight. Josh Friedman, who's War of the Worlds, Terminator, Sarah Connor Chronicles, and Avatar 2. That's a pretty good pair of people. It's funny because it's hard to do. Apparently, Fox, Warner Brothers, Sony, and HBO have all tried and failed to do Foundation. So this is going to be an ambitious project for Apple. That's pretty exciting.
Hopefully, it's an environment which it can finally succeed, because there's a lot of those old like classics. There are people that have such a, I don't want to say like inbred, but such a science fiction fan inbreeding idea of what it absolutely must be,
right,
that they're not willing to make it into realizing that Asimov did not write a TV screenplay or a movie screenplay. He wrote a novel. And now if you turn the novel into a screenplay, you have to make certain adjustments so that people can actually follow it. And furthermore, if you're going to spend $500 million on this, you can't just make it for the diminishing herd of aging 1960s science fiction readers.
Exactly. If you're only making this for the Asimov fans, you definitely have a limited audience. That's so true.
This is go ahead.
Most of them are on retirement income at this point. They can't. they're borrowing their nieces and nephews like HBO codes to watch TV at this point.
This is I think today or yesterday was the 50th anniversary of the release of 2001. And there's a great piece talking about the difficult relationship between Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke. They were writing the book while he was making the movie, and Clarke was very unhappy with what Kubrick was doing. In fact, there's a story that during the first screening of the movie, Arthur C. Clarke left at the intermission in tears. In tears. So it's a long, difficult road to make science fiction into something like a movie or a television show. It's hard to do.
Go
ahead.
And yet 2001, the movie, and 2001, the novel are both brilliant.
Yeah, but yeah. Different. But very different. Yeah. Go ahead, Lori.
When it comes to science fiction, especially, the key is that the screenwriters, the directors, they have to love the genre. And if you love the genre, then you're going to make a good movie. You're going to make a good TV show. It's the key is just that they have to understand the little nuances that sci-fi is a genre. And it used to be kind of a, you know, C or B level genre at best. And it just recently has grown to be more popular amongst just general audiences. But especially when it comes to Asimov, fans of sci-fi in general, they're going to pick apart a TV show or a movie that's based in science fiction, no matter who wrote the original story. So if you love the genre, you're going to present something that fans of the genre are going to appreciate. That's kind of the key.
So what you're saying is that David Lynch hated Dune. Hated it. Red iPhone, are we all excited? We kind of knew this would happen. I wish that they had made it available for the iPhone 10. It's only the iPhone 8.
8, yeah.
That's where Renee is right now, taking a briefing on the Red iPhone. This is Product Red, which means it raises money for AIDS research, of course. And they did one thing right, I think. They put the glass face on the Red iPhone 8 is black, not white. People complained about last year's iPhone, Red iPhone 7. It looked like a candy cane. This is a little bit better looking.
You know what, though? People are going to complain this year that it's black.
I know.
There's always going to be.
Yeah, I know. You can order it today. It'll be shipping Friday, day after tomorrow. $699 for the 64 gig, $799 for an 8 plus. 64 gig 8 and $799 for the 8 plus. Anybody going to buy one? I love the red ones, but I can't imagine spending buying a whole new phone just for that.
I really do love the red ones and you know, everything that it stands for.
Yep.
But this time, you know, the iPhone X is really where I'm at.
Me too.
So,
me too.
You know, it would be tough to go back.
I completely agree with you. We were talking earlier with Micah Sargent, your colleague at Mobile Nations, Lori. He hosted iOS Today because Megan was out, and Micah's great. And we were talking about this problem that Apple's facing, which is that they've got one user interface for the iPhone X, the home buttonless iPhone X, and then another user face for the iPhone 8 and the iPad. I prefer, frankly, the iPhone X. I really like it. But I don't know if this can translate to an iPad, for instance. Go ahead, Lori, and then...
About the gestures. I completely understand what you're talking about with the comfort level of the user interface of the iPhone X. It's the gestures.
Yep.
Our brains adapt to that so much faster.
Yeah.
Yeah. It surprised me even. I thought it was going to be hard to get used to the iPhone X gestures. And after not even a week, not only was I super comfortable with the way you interact with the interface, I found button-based iPhones to be really frustrating. It just makes more sense to what my brain thinks I should do next. Whereas when you're using an iPad or iPhone 8 or iPhone 7, it feels limiting. My brain has to be jarred into remembering what to do as opposed to just naturally doing what kind of happens when I'm using a gesture-based iPhone X.
So you'd vote for the 10 to become the future of iOS, the 10.
Absolutely. I would love Apple to be able to allow that into the future phones and tablets for sure. Yeah. I think it would definitely work across all iOS.
You agree, Jim?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why they didn't do it. They could have done a red 10. This is the white with chrome 10. They could have made that back.
I don't know.
Maybe they will. I don't know either. Maybe they will. Maybe they want to juice the sales of the 8.
It doesn't matter to them, though, as long as they're selling.
That's true.
I think they know that they're definitely going to sell more of the 8 than they would have a much more expensive phone.
Yeah.
So, So if you're raising money for a good cause, better raise more money for a good cause.
Yeah.
I don't know why they couldn't do both, though. But to the earlier points, I just hope that Apple doesn't get into this like sort of dogmatic jag of removing clicky buttons and physical interface from a device just because they don't like physical buttons and clicky things. I think that, for instance, with the iPads, you don't have you got a lot of room. You can improve things with things that are tactile. I still think that one of the big bummers was I still to this day miss the fact that you have a physical switch that can either mute the device or just simply say, please lock the screen so you don't keep twisting and turning every time that I shift on my sofa. I still miss it because I think having some sort of a physical button that does something that is holistic to the entire experience, that's a really useful thing to happen. The home button is a bigger problem, I think, with the iPad, though, because there is something kind of, I wouldn't call it off-putting, but something green and glowing about the idea of, well, this button is, because you use the iPad in horizontal mode and vertical mode and keep switching them, having such a crucial interface element that switches its position relative to the orientation of the screen, yeah, maybe that's something that you can think, just a little bit offended by that as a designer, and perhaps we should fix that. But I hope that I think that the best interface is a combination of tactile and virtual. I'd love to see them make it as great as a combination. Greater as a combination than it would as simply one or the other.
Boy, I'm impressed. Epic Games is making some money on Fortnite. Released to the public on iOS a couple of weeks ago, it's now making close to $2 million a day. And it's a free game.
$2 million a day in just like costumes.
Yeah, it's not even like how to play. It's just it's just cosmetic stuff.
Yeah. On digital goods, as they call it.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of impressive.
Well, this is why I want Tim to break it down. Whenever he starts off WWDC by saying, last quarter alone, we paid out over $800 kajillion to developers. And say, okay, how much of this went to the kitchen table developer team that produced this really cool and useful utility versus how much was a new hat for a Pokemon?
Actually, one of the very popular things on Fortnite is for sale is dance moves to give your character. Yeah,
what kind of? So I remember doing this when I would play World of Warcraft, but I haven't actually played Fortnite. So my guess is, can you buy famous?
They're taunts.
Okay. Yep.
It's to taunt the person you.
Same
just
idea,
killed,
yeah.
Stand over them and go.
So can you buy like the Nicki Minaj dance move?
I haven't seen that. Can you dab? I don't know. Yeah, that would be kind of fun. Fortnite is an awesome game. I'm a big fan. Terrible at it, though. It has several different modes, but the most popular, I would imagine, is the Battle Royale mode, where 100 people drop into this island and you win if you're the last person to survive. You kill or others have killed everybody else off. But it's fun. And you can build forts. So,
do you have to pay to build a fort?
No. All of that's free. But it has the problem all iOS game ports have, which is that they're trying to duplicate a control, a device. A gamepad on the screen, which means the left one is how you steer, the right one is how. And that's just, I don't like that interface very much. It's not a touch native game, let's put it that way.
Do you play Fortnite on an iPad or do you play it
on an iPad. I play it on my Mac. It's actually, it really runs well on an iMac Pro. It's best game for a $4,000. You got a keyboard. That's right.
Yeah.
Best game ever for a $4,000 computer. Let me just tell you. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will give you your chance to pick anything you want. I should tell you, Lori, that Jim often picks a heavy metal album. So
anything we want. It doesn't have to be an app or
anything you want.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, that gives the world is your oyster. We'll get to that in just a second. And now you know Lori's thinking. She's going to come up with something wacky, something wild. By the way, Steve Wozniak has now quit Facebook as well, just so you know, everybody. I used to follow Steve. The funny thing is, I've quit Facebook. Steve's quit Facebook. But Steve, unlike me, has not quit Foursquare. So even though you can't follow Steve on Facebook, you can know that he is the mayor of the Burger King at Dubai, in Dubai. So those things are, he's not completely private now. Not completely. It's the chuck wagon he likes to go to down your way. Jim, isn't it? Is it the Chuck Wagon? What is the restaurant that Waz loves?
Oh, I have no idea.
It's not a very good restaurant. It's got a big wagon wheel out front.
That's usually how I define a good restaurant. Either a huge fiberglass cow or a wagon wheel means, guess what? Guess what, honey? We're pulling over for lunch right now. I don't care if it's 10 a.m.
It's on Berryessa Road, Jim. Go on over for lunch. I think you'll enjoy it. You might see Waz there.
You never know.
If he's not in Dubai. Our show today brought to you... Oh, this is bad news. A week from today, your taxes are due. At least in the U.S. If you're in Canada, you get a little more time. Jim, do you file in U.S. taxes now, or do you get to file in the Canadian tax system?
I do everything.
Yeah, you pay Canadian tax, too.
I pay everything.
Everybody gets money.
Everybody.
I enjoy doing taxes. Now, once I founded Twit, we had a company and we have, bookkeepers and CPA. I didn't get to do my taxes anymore. But just recently, I started doing my mom's taxes because she was paying like $500 to have somebody prepare taxes. I said, Mom, I can do that for you. And this year I'm doing hers and I'm doing my daughter's taxes because she got her first job this year. And I'm going to invite Abby to come watch so she knows for future reference. Teach a man to pay taxes. Do a man's taxes. He'll be paid for a year. Teach a man to
pay his own tax. This isn't going to work. TurboTax is the easiest way to do your taxes. You can file online with confidence. And now with TurboTax Live, it's even better. You're not on your own anymore. You can now have a personal review of your tax return with a CPA or an EA, that's an enrolled agent, right on your screen. Quickly connect to a tax expert via one-way video, so they're not looking at you, even though you're looking at them. And you can do it, by the way, not just for filing the return, but as often as you need for answers and advice on your taxes. The new tax bills changed a lot of things. A lot of things. They're up on all the new tax laws, so they can give you advice to going forward. You can even have the expert review your return before you file and make any necessary changes.
This is the new way to do your taxes.
It's the new way to do your taxes. And it's all backed by 100% accuracy guarantee. I am a huge fan of TurboTax. I've used it for years. And I encourage you to try it. If you're worried about tax time, if you just realized, oh my God, I have 1 week. TurboTaxLive.com/MacBreak. Now you can connect with a TurboTax expert today. TurboTaxLive.com/MacBreak. We thank them for their support. It really is. Somebody, Coleman in the chat room says, TurboTax is so easy. Yes, it is. All right. Let's see. At the bottom of the show, the back of the book, as I call it, it's time for your picks of the week. Let's start with Mr. Dalrymple. Jimmy?
All right. So you know that I like my hard rock and metal.
I do.
With some groove.
And you've always given us great picks.
It's gotta have some groove for me. So over the weekend, I was listening to a playlist I actually have on Apple Music that I made, and it's shared on my profile. But one of the bands that I had in the playlist, I had to go listen to more songs because I just love it. It's Rob Zombie.
Oh, yeah.
And they just put out a new live album. So if you're looking for an album to start with Rob Zombie, there's an album called Past, Present, and Future. And it's like the greatest hits from White Zombie, Rob Zombie stuff. Some great stuff in there, and it just grooves. I mean, Rob and John Five know how to make a song. So I really enjoyed listening to a lot of this stuff. Thunderkiss 65, More Human Than Human is one of my favorites. I love that song, More Human Than Human. Just wonderful song, and it will groove.
Past,
so
present, and future. That's it. Like, if you want to get introduced to the zombie oeuvre, you would go here, and you would get it all.
That is the album. Now, you can move out from there and get, all the other albums, but this is it. You're gonna get a lot of great music on this album.
I want to get White Zombie's super sexy swinging sounds.
Well, you can do that, too.
That sounds like my kind of album. Hey, if people want to follow you on Apple Music, can they?
Yeah. Yeah, I have you just search for me, and I'm on Apple Music.
Just as Jim Dalrymple, there's no...
Yep. Okay, my profile is open, so you can see what I'm listening to.
I'm adding you right now.
See playlists that I've built. I have a mellow rock playlist, with some 70s and some 60s acoustic type music.
Nice.
I have a driving playlist, which is what Rob Zombie is on, to get me all hyped up when I go out in the car.
This is one of the best things about Apple Music is following people who have good taste, because I have none.
Yeah.
But it's also one of the most embarrassing things when you're like known for being a like hard punk rocker and you're listening to like Disney music, because that's
rainy
my problem.
Days and Sundays always get me down.
Yep.
What is your pick of the week, Andy Anatko?
Gee, I'm not. Okay, I'm not going to do it. But
go! I want your picks.
knowing that there are going to be two like really, really cool picks that I'm going to have to like write down because they're going to be really cool and probably something I don't play usually. I will, my musical pick will be the Metropolitan Opera production of Jules Massenet's Cendrillon, which is an opera based on Cinderella that I'm going to be going. It opens on April 13th. If you are near New York City, realize that usually rush tickets can be had for in the orchestra for $25. You just go to the metopera.org website after noon p.m. and they put these things on sale. I bought these, but these tickets I actually paid like full price for months in advance because number one, chiefly because two of my favorite sopranos are singing in it. Joyce DiDonato, who is an amazing mezzo and also an amazing educator. But oh, my goodness, I just love her voice. And also another soprano playing the fairy godmother, Kathleen Kim, who she doesn't record much, unfortunately. But every time I've seen her performances on YouTube, they've always really, really amazed me. So it's a really good looking production. I've never seen this opera before. But that was the idea of, again, two people that I've never seen perform live before that totally looking forward to. It doesn't mean I'm paying the top whack of $375, but I was able to say I'm not gonna take the chance that I can get cheap $25 tickets. I'm actually spending actual money for this. So, and if chances are, if you don't get to see it in New York City, I think that it's going to be presented in theaters. As a matter of fact, I think it's actually going to be the Saturday matinee performance that I'm seeing on Saturday, like something like the 28th or something like that. So you can see it in theaters for $20, and it'll probably be on PBS later in the year because most of the simulcast to theaters productions turn out to be a Metropolitan Live at the Met or whatever, great performances at the Met, I think they call it the series. Definitely going to be worth watching. I don't believe it's going to be one of those ones where everybody dies at the end and everybody's sad and dead and horrible and covered with blood. I believe this is the fun part of Cinderella, not the original Grimm's fairy tale where the evil sisters dance to their death at the wedding in iron shoes that are heated to red hot things. Anyway, so again, if I'm going to do a music pick, I'm afraid that that's the very, very well motivated, but not terribly hip.
So we now have opera and groove rock. I wonder, whatever could Lori Gill have for us?
I wasn't planning on picking a music
You don't have to. Pick. I'm not so picking
good,
music.
Good, because so over the weekend, I finally saw the Dario Argento movie, The Mother of Tears, which is the third in the trilogy of the Three Mothers. And so my pick this week is The Three Mothers Trilogy by Dario Argento. The first one is Suspiria. The second one is Inferno. And the third one is The Mother of Tears, which is actually not that good of a movie, to be honest. But
what would the genre of these movies be?
They're a horror film, but they're supernatural horror. The first two, they're all three about witches.
Oh, I love
the first one. Suspiria is about sort of witchcraft in a ballet theater, and the second one is even more confusing with home that was
Suspiria. It used to be owned by a witch. I've heard of that one. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And they're incredibly beautiful, and they're also really, really difficult to understand until you get to the movie, The Mother of Tears, which clarifies so many things that are completely unexplained in both Suspiria and Inferno. So Mother of Tears needs to be watched because it makes Suspiria and Inferno make sense. So I have to say the trilogy, because if you just watch Inferno, you might be completely confused by what happened, and you need Mother of Tears to kind of anchor in those first two movies, even though it's actually not particularly good compared to the other two.
So this came out in 2007. We're not talking about a movie in the theaters today. This is something.
No, these are old.
Can you watch it on
movies.
Netflix, or where are you watching?
You can. You can actually. You can rent them on
Amazon or Google iTunes. Or iTunes. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't wait. I don't know what it is. My favorite supernatural creature. I love witches much better than vampires and zombies.
There's something sort of mysterious about them. Yeah. They're a little bit, they're dark, but kind of inviting.
Yeah. Awesome.
Rob Zombie's kind of cool, though.
Oh, that's a different kind of zombie. I like that zombie. So we've got zombies, we got witches, we got opera. I don't know how I could follow that, but I actually want to give a little credit to somebody who tweeted me and reminded me that I should mention this. I've been taking online courses. I just finished an online course on programming. I'm really enjoying it. And this is one of the courses that's on my list. It's the fastest growing course in the history of UC Berkeley, Foundations of Data Science. And you can take it for free on EDX. EDX is the platform where I just took a great programming course. And I've mentioned this before. But if you want to know more about data science, Data 8X, the Foundations of Data Science. It is not for computer scientists particularly, or even for professional programmers. Now, you notice it says it's $357. It's free to take it. It's only if you want to get a certificate, a professional certificate, would you pay for it. These are fun courses. I like the platform, frankly. I feel like it's a easy-to-use platform, easy to follow along. And data science is huge. So the Foundations of Data Science. They say it started April 2nd, but that's not how these things work. You can pick it up and start it anytime you want. It's just now available as of April 2nd. The most popular course ever. And this is, boy, I tell you, this is what I love about the internet. This is one of the good things about the internet is you could, as long as you have internet access and a computer or something you can watch video on, and you can take these college level fantastic courses and learn so much, and I think you could train yourself to be a computer scientist in your spare time for free. This does use Python 3 as the language, which is a pretty darn good language to learn anyway. So Foundations of Data Science, Computational Thinking with Python. It is Data 8X, University of California, Berkeley, just released at edx.org. So we got everything. We got everything in here. Everything. And if Renee were here, we'd have a red iPhone too. Yeah. Lori, you are great. You are coming back. You're wonderful. Lori
Thank
Gill,
you.
Deputy Managing Editor of iMore. She confided in me, and I'm gonna break a confidence at the beginning of the show before we started. She was a little nervous. See? That was nothing to be nervous about.
It was great. I had a lot of fun chatting with you all. That was really great.
Thank you so much for being here. We'll see you again soon.
And thank
next
you for
time
having
coming down here.
Yeah, I'll come down and visit. It'll be great.
Yeah. Andy Iannacco, always a slice, as they say, ihnatko.com or ihnatko dot on the internet, on the Twitter, as they say.
I never had that Twitter handle stolen from me because anyone who tried probably misspelled it and left the actual spelling code
didn't know how to,
for me.
I have no idea. ihnatko. And the legendary Jim Dalrymple, loopinsight.com. always wonderful to have you on.
Double goat. Wow.
Double goat, yeah. Baby. He's got the double goat, one for each cleft of his beard. Always a pleasure. Hey, thank you all for being here. We do Mac Break Weekly every Tuesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time. That's 1800 UTC. If you want to watch live, please do. You can do it on our stream, twit.tv/live. Or you could do it in studio. We had a nice couple visiting us. Were you both entranced and intrigued? No. Yeah, why not? I think Joe enjoyed it, but Rachel, visiting from Philly today. Nice to have you both. If you do want to visit us in studio, we love having a live studio audience. All you have to do is email tickets at twit.tv. We'll put a seat out for you. If you're watching the stream and you got a computer, you might as well open up the chat room. It's a great way to participate. irc.twit.tv. irc.twit.tv. And let's see. If you can't watch live, you can't be here live, what could you do? Oh, you could go to the website, twit.tv/mbw. You'll find all the shows we do there, audio and video. And, of course, you can always subscribe in your favorite podcast application like Overcast or Pocket Casts or iTunes or, you know, wherever you get your podcasts. Just subscribe. That way you'll get every episode. Thanks for being here. Sad to say, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Break time is over.